If you go by the theory of federalism, the House represents the people and the Senate represents the states. So does that mean if the governor is at odds with the federal government, our senators are too? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Plenty to talk about with Senator Mark Begich, so call early. Statewide and toll-free, the number 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. And Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Senator Mark Begich of Alaska is our guest today, live and direct on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And Alaska Senator Mark Begich is with us in the studio here in the lovely university neighborhood of Anchorage. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you very much. Always good to be here. And I had to weave through a few of the projects that are out there on the street to get here, but that's a good sign. That means there's people working and projects happening, so it's great to be here.
Yeah, so hopefully they'll get it done before it's time to put it all under visqueen balloons.
You know, but sometimes we like to see that, don't we? That's kind of the architecture of the wintertime. You know, that means jobs are happening, people are working, but, you know, we then have that visqueen that blows, you know, about January, February, and it's kind of flapping away.
Yeah. Okay, well,
it's great to be back.
I'm sure that, you know, there's always a thunder of calls for whenever we have anybody from the delegation here. So while we're waiting, I'll just start with one of my own, which is basically the BP spill and your committee assignments and where you see your responsibility as lying as this drama continues to unfold.
You bet. First, you know, it's truly a tragedy what's occurring down there, not only from the spill activity, but, you know, we can't forget the folks that perished on the first day that the rig blew up and those families who are still dealing with those losses. But now we see after over 40 days, BP's inability to shut off the flow or slow it down even. And from my perspective, it doesn't matter what committees you sit on in the U.S. Senate. Everyone is focused on this and what we can do. I sit on the Commerce Committee. Obviously, that has a lot of issues around technology and the oceans and what's going on in the Gulf and what the impact will be. So we all have our own individual roles for our committees. But, you know, I sit kind of in a unique role, one being from Alaska, who has experienced a significant oil spill. Our state, as you know, with Exxon Valdez, have a lot of lessons we've learned that we can kind of deliver in some ways down to the Gulf, but also recognizing that even in this tragedy, we have to figure out at the end of the day, not only how to cap this off and figure out how to deal with the damage, but the long term is what are we going to do in this country for a long-term energy plan that's comprehensive, that recognizes oil and gas is part of the equation, but at the end of the day, we're going to have wind and solar and geothermal, a much more broader comprehensive energy plan. I think you'll see a lot of that discussion when we get back. We'll see a lot of pressure, obviously, put on the companies as well as the agencies to determine what went wrong in this spill, what we need to do to improve the system. Anyone who says, well, you know, before this, a lot of people say, well, we have the best already. That doesn't mean we can't improve. And obviously, this shows that the contingency plans that BP had did not work, that they are now experimenting as they move through the system. We had some issues with MMS, one of the services that the federal government has to manage the permitting out there. So we have a combination of things that we have to seriously look at and change. And I think you'll see lots of legislation. But being from Alaska, we have a unique role, because we've experienced this. Obviously, we experienced it with a very finite, you know, we knew when the spill occurred, we knew the gallons, we knew where it was going. In this situation, it's not clear the total volume, it's not clear where it might end up. So there's a lot of unknowns that are being unfolded literally as we sit here every hour, every day. But I can say that every resource that the federal government has, from the military to the civilian component, is engaged in this effort.
Well, I'm thinking that people in the industry, and we saw this during the Exxon Valdez, too, if you didn't work for for Exxon, you were really worked up that right. this had happened, and you were going to look at the way you did business as a company.
That's right.
And so there were certain cost-cutting things that is already coming out that pretty clearly were very bad decisions, bad uh-huh. risks.
Uh-huh. I think what you're going to see, and this is, you know, I was on a show this morning, and we talked about this is not just a Gulf issue. It's a worldwide issue. And what you're going to see, because I guarantee you there's other countries looking at, okay, why did this happen? What have the oil companies, in this case BP, done there? And is that affecting them maybe in their own country? So people will look at this from a much broader perspective. The other thing that I think happened, you know, you have 1,000 wells operating in the Gulf down there. You got about 100 every year put into production. So maybe, and we'll see more as the whole report comes through, you know, you obviously saw kind of a routine, you know, just the permit gets issued, you go drill and off you go. And I think maybe that also played a significant role in kind of not doing the due diligence. As I described this morning, I mean, I can't recall a time that I've seen in the national news, one of the Gulf oil explorations or rigs being sued for their development. But in Alaska, no matter what we do, we get sued. And so in a lot of ways, it's bad. But on the flip side, it's probably given us another layer of scrutiny that maybe we not liked it. It's given us a stronger base to work from here in a sense of what we have to offer and how we can do the business. Look at what happened with the pipeline last week. Closed down for 2.5 days. An amount of oil spilled over, but into a containment area, cleaned up, managed. No one in the national news covered it. I mean, think about it. The pipeline was shut down. An oil spill, you would think that would be of interest with the Gulf activity. Why wasn't it? Because we had redundancy in our plans, our contingency plans, and it worked. Not only worked, it worked on the first piece of the plan, not the second or the third or fourth layer. The first piece played, cleaned up, worked.
1-800-478-8255 to speak with Senator Mark Begich live on Talk of Alaska statewide. 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at APRN.org. Well, it was a little bit flippant, probably, the way I started the show, but still, there are so many ways now. It's pretty clear that Governor Parnell is going to campaign against the federal government.
Yeah.
And you're in the same party as the president
right.
and the administration. So it puts you in an odd position, doesn't it?
Not really. I mean, I look at it this way. I mean, at the you know, the bottom line is I represent Alaska. I don't represent my party. I don't represent some special interest group. I represent Alaskans. And issue by issue, I take on where I find differences with the administration. Most recently, we had a plan down in Southeast that they put forward on their long-term, which they claim to be a long-term framework on management of the Tongass. It really wasn't. It was, as I called it, a frame. There was nothing inside the frame. It was just a nice frame. So I have no problem taking on the administration when I think they are wrong, when I think Kensington Mine, another example down in Juneau, which we thought was a very good development. The federal government was wrong on that. They're wrong on the MPRA issue where Corps of Engineers denied the development at this point because of a permit issue and one of the issues around a bridge. But putting that aside, I think I actually talked about this during my speech to the legislature about be careful, you know, slapping the hand that feeds you many times. In the case of the state budget, 25% of it is from the federal government. $2 billion. There's well over $10 billion in the economy here that moves from the federal government. Maybe Indian Health Services, the military funding, that all feeds into this economy. The road construction, a variety of things. That's all healthy for us in the sense of the return we get. So in one way, I understand the politics. I would just hope that, you know, I know Governor Parnell's a lawyer. Lawyers like to sue. He's carried that forward, I guess. But that's his decision. He has that right as a governor. I just would be cautious on let's try to work things out, get resolution, rather than just suing whenever we think it's politically advantageous.
Well, before we go to our first caller from Talkeetna, that kind of reminds me that there is an appropriations bill that's kind of hanging there, the supplemental. Is there anything of special interest to Alaska in that that you'd like to highlight?
Well, the supplemental we closed out last week. It had obviously some emergency dollars for the Yukon area for the fishing and the YK. It's about a $5 million allocation. As you know, it was declared a disaster, a fishing disaster, an economic disaster. So $5 million will be available now to assist the communities up there. Obviously, when you look at the supplemental, that was more of an emergency and war funding, and that's where the real focus was. But we were able to secure some resources, which were important, especially up in the YK. For 2 years, you know, they've had enormous downturn in their fishing and their economic well-being because of it. So this helps them. We think the number should be 10 million, but we're happy with five. That's not bad. And we'll be working through the rest of the year, Senator Murkowski and I, to figure out how to secure some additional resources. But we're very excited that the first five is on its way.
Becky joins the program with Senator Mark Begich. Becky from Talkeetna, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Good. Very good.
All right. I guess I'm going to take this in a different direction, although I have fished and tendered on the lower Yukon, so I'm familiar with those problems. But I was wondering how the senator felt about the fact that last month the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation gave the Alaska Railroad a permit to spray the glyphosate herbicide Aquamaster and the surfactant Agridex to spray it on portions of the railroad track from Indian, which is south of Anchorage, to Seward, including 30 acres in the Seward yard. And the reason why I bring this up is I know, Senator, when you were mayor of the municipality of Anchorage, in September 2006, when they were trying to get a permit to spray the whole rail belt, you commented very strongly to DEC that you did not support the spray permit for
the rail belt
due to your constituents' concerns. And last summer, the vice president of the railroad admitted that this current permit is a stepping stone to a broader herbicide policy for the whole railroad. And if they spray, it would be this month, June, the last part of the month, it'll be the first state administration that has allowed spraying since Jay Hammond stopped spraying on state rights of ways, and the first time that there will be spraying on the railroad since 1982. So I just thought I'd ask you how you felt about this.
My position hasn't changed. I think back then, I remember that. Actually, when you were describing this, I was thinking, you know, I'm going to tell you about the letter, but you already knew it. So, but
well, I got your letter right in front of me. I got a copy of it.
Thank you very much for doing that. But my position hasn't changed. I think the railroad and what they're trying to do, obviously, is try to do a little sampling and try to move down this path, which, again, you stated very clearly that since Jay Hammond days, they have not been able to do that because of the potential environmental hazard and the problems that we have there. So my position hasn't changed. I think DEC should not allow them to do this. And the damage that it will cause, or potential damage, because that's always what you have to measure here, is probably unmeasurable at this point. And that's why you shouldn't allow them to do it.
Well, awesome. Thank you very much. And
thank you very much, Becky.
And all your work.
Thank you, Becky.
All right. Thank you, Becky from Talkeetna. Of course, the U.S. Senate is not likely to be involved in that one.
Yes and no. And I say this, and that is, there's times when we do comment on situations that are occurring. You know, for example, when the election reform issues, when the Supreme Court made a ruling and decided that corporations could be people, which is kind of its own debate, the Senate and the House in Juneau were talking about some legislation. We actually sent them a letter and said, you know, we agree with you. Move forward and create some disclosure and transparency on this. It's important. Even though it was a state legislation, I think it was important for us to voice our opinion. Now, I will tell you, there was a couple of legislators that said, mind your own business. And my view is, I live in Alaska, and I think I have a right to comment. Plus, we heard from a lot of Alaskans on this about what can be done. So even though this is a DEC issue, we're not bashful if we think it could damage or hurt Alaskans. We're going to comment.
Let's go to Caroline, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Caroline.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank Senator Begich for the great job that he's doing to represent Alaska. And today I also want to talk about the railroad. I live in Homer, and I am very, very concerned about the safety of the corridor between Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula mm-hmm. for safety and the tragic accident that took someone's life this weekend. I'm referring you to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 that has a paragraph in there about a vision for high-speed rail in America, which yes. we are a part of. And it says President Obama proposes to help address the nation's transportation challenges by investing in efficient high-speed passenger rail network of 100 to 600-mile intercity corridors that connect communities across America. I would like to know what Senator Begich feels about this, and if it's possible and feasible, where I could go to figure out the costs of this, because I know I have to have numbers before we go forth, but there's a number of people who are prepared to sign petitions down here mm-hmm. to have another way to link the Kenai Peninsula with Anchorage besides that dangerous highway, beautiful dangerous highway. Mm-hmm. And also, we are at the same time concerned about energy efficiency. And then the jobs that this might create, and opening up some properties perhaps that are landlocked right now, but a railroad would open them up like the old West days. So, Senator Begich, what would you think about this?
Yeah, let me say that when I was mayor, it was an initiative we started for Anchorage to Matsu as kind of the first kind of phase, because the higher volume of traffic of commuter rail. There has been a study done by the railroad on commuter rail, and they've done segments, basically Anchorage to Matsu. I don't think they've done anything further than South Anchorage, actually, down to the Kenai, but I think the railroad does have analysis that they've done. The issue with commuter rail and the high-speed commuter rail, you're going to need different kind of rail lines, and it's just a whole different system. Now, saying that, we have recognized in the transportation legislation that moved through, maybe in the stimulus money that you've referred to, the recovery money, yeah. as well as future formula programs, rural states like Alaska have a hard time competing because on those commuter rail line issues. Because here's what happens. That funding comes together, and then you got to, let's say, Los Angeles or Seattle or New York that have a higher volume of passengers, and they're the ones that kind of win these grants. So what we're trying to do is look at how to carve out a segment for rural in our transportation legislation that will come down the line over the next year and figure out how we can maximize that. But to be very frank with you, I agree with you on that road. I mean, it's a beautiful road. It's a scenic bypass, but it is very dangerous, especially as the summer approaches and the winter. I've been on that road coming from Kenai. I used to have to go bound to Kenai for business yeah. on a monthly basis and drive back at 11 o'clock at night. So I know how dangerous that can be, especially in the winter and with ice. Now, saying that, I think the odds are that if the railroad wanted to move into commuter rail, which I think they should, Anchorage to Matsu would be the first target because of the high volume of traffic and people mm-hmm. they could take off. But I would recommend, and I think you have some initiative, it sounds like, which I think is great, talking to the railroad, get that report they did on the Anchorage Matsu. That will give you some numbers that you can okay. work with. And then the second thing, I like your idea of going out there and asking your community to sign a petition, and then I would present that, especially right now while the railroad is selecting a new, they've just in the process of selecting a new CEO to run the railroad. This is the right time to start, influencing. It's a state-owned railroad. In theory, you, me, uh-huh. residents own that railroad. So we should have our voice, and you should put together. I like the idea of the petition.
Thank you.
Okay.
And you will hear from us.
Very good.
Because we really do hope that this can happen, and I'm going to look for your support in it.
Excellent.
And also other politicians as we get toward our election time.
Excellent.
And get on the bandwagon and join you perhaps in supporting our communities down here with another route that will perhaps save some lives. We're very sad about the young life that was taken this weekend.
Yes.
I really appreciate your thoughts on the answer.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Caroline from Homer, our guest, Senator Mark Begich, telephone number 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and from Port Alexander, this is Sue. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mark Begich. Sue?
Thank you. Mark, I am right now sitting in my kitchen looking out my window at Chatham Straits in southeast Alaska. But I'm thinking about an interview I heard by a fisherman in Louisiana yesterday on Raven Radio, and I'm feeling really sad because we're fishermen here too. And I have recently read that British Petroleum, or BP, or made $239 billion in 2009. And that's billion, not million, but billion dollars. And that only 32 countries in the entire world have a larger economy than they do. And I also read that you have taken the position against something that's called Big Oil Bailout Prevention Act, which actually removes the oil industry's liability limit for spills. It's currently at a paltry $75 million, which sounds like a lot to me as a person, but to a company like BP, that's nothing. That's like an allowance. That's nothing to them. And I am wondering if, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong, that is your position, but I'm wondering if you really believe that protecting oil company actually protects our sustainable resources in Alaska, and it protects our shores, and it protects our waters, and if it protects the health and welfare of all of Alaska's people, and does it protect the people who hunt and fish for subsistence? Does it protect my job and my business here in Port Alexander to take those positions? And I'm just wondering how you can justify your position.
Well, first, Sue, let me correct you. That's not my position. So I'm not sure how that was portrayed, but here's what I've said very clearly. $75 million is too low. Not only too low, I think I've said and been quoted way, way too low. It was set, 20 years ago. They didn't inflation-proof it, a variety of other things. The formula, I think, is a poor formula. The second thing I've said is when we develop liability policy, let's make sure we do it not in a vacuum, in a crisis mode, because people right now, all they want to do is punish people, which I don't disagree in a sense of BP. They got a lot of responsibility here. They have an obligation to pay for every dime of cleanup. They have a responsibility to ensure that the businesses that are suffering are not only taken care of for today's economic loss, but future economic loss. So I agree that needs to be changed, but what we need to do is do it in a thoughtful way. And I will tell you that, again, the number is way too low. We're working on some ideas right now to change this, and you'll see that come forward. So I know the press like to get just little bits and pieces because it's in their best, benefit in order to create the story they want to create. Now, saying that, we also have, to be very clear, we have no energy plan for this country. Senate and Congresses of the past, both Democrat and Republican, have failed to develop one. And now we pay the consequences for a variety of things. For example, almost 70% of our oil is imported from foreign countries. Of that, a sizable amount comes from countries that hate us, that dislike us, that use money against us. And as long as we continue to consume at the rate we're consuming at, we have a moral obligation not to close our eyes to where this oil is developed and know that as we transition into a much better diversified energy portfolio, which I believe over the next 20 and 30 years we can do it, if Congress has the wherewithal to do it. And I think people like myself are going to continue to hammer away because we have to have a much more diversified energy base. That's why Southeast is doing what they're doing, getting less on diesel, more on hydro and other resources. That's exactly the way we should approach it. But we have to be realistic and honest with ourselves. As we continue to consume, we will have an obligation, a moral obligation, that if we're going to consume oil at the rates we're consuming it, then we have an obligation to produce it. We can't just close our eyes to the rest of the world and say, well, we don't care where we get it as long as we get it. So that's what I've talked about. So I agree the liability limits are too low, need to be changed. We're going to do that. Second, we're going to hold BP fully accountable for all costs associated with this spill, no matter what they say. As Secretary Salazar says, he's going to keep his boot on the neck of BP until they pay up every dime. And we are not going to let the folks in the Gulf suffer what Alaska suffered, which was 20 years of litigation and delay by the oil company of Exxon in order for them to make more money on the lives of people who suffered. So I hear what you're saying, but I that whatever that information is that you had, whoever reported that was wrong, now you heard it.
Well, that's great. I'm really glad to hear that, and I don't know still how you stand on the act that has been proposed.
No, that's what you're talking about is basically somebody using some spin language for several moves to change the liability cap. We can rest assured that the liability cap will be raised, and the rest of it's pretty much propaganda right now, Sue.
Yeah, and Sue, let me just say that it's not going to be in the millions. It's going to be in the billions when you get with these big companies. So I don't know, you know, and you're right, there's some great one-liners that people are putting out there because it's good politics right now. And that's why I said earlier, we have to be careful in these crisis moments that we don't design policy that just responds to emotions. Do we need to change it? Absolutely. Should be much more aggressive than it is? Absolutely. Do we need to hold BP accountable for all costs related to this, one up and down from private sector to the cleanup? Yes, they do. What will the amount be? I can't tell you. There's three or four pieces of legislation now. We're drafting one, which I think will move us to a much more robust approach of how to deal with these companies in any situation. Of course, you don't want to get to this situation. That's the first thing, that we should not be in this situation. But if we do, we have to have a pretty robust formula. And right now, again, the current formula is obsolete, to say the least.
Yeah, it just seems, I don't even understand why there should be a liability limit, really. You know,
well, it's pretty hard to screw out what they were thinking at the time, Sue.
That's right.
I want to say, and we didn't really ask very well, I don't think. We thought, well, now they're going to fix it after Exxon Valdez.
Right, we had an assumption that things would get better and we would never have to dip into this.
Yeah.
And that's not the case.
And then they not only did they cap the liability, but they capped the amount.
They capped the amount, they capped the fund of how much could be collected.
And we used it up in its own dang IU.
Yeah, 2016, the liability fund that they pay into was going to expire. And Lisa Murkowski and I have put together a bill that says it's not going to expire. Matter of fact, we're going to increase it so it gets up to a $10 billion maximum in that fund.
Well, I have one more energy plan call, it looks like, from Jim in Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim, with Senator Mark Begich.
Hello, Senator.
Yes.
I am one of your longtime supporters.
Thank you.
One would like to know what you are going to do about that proposed loan and to the nuclear industry. It will be an authorization by Congress to do that, and it only encourages more nuclear installations, which are a continuing problem for them because we have not solved what we're going to do with the waste.
Let me, if I am taking you here, Jim, on your issue, my understanding is I think you're referring to the loans that the president has authorized, I think, on two plants to move forward. I do not believe, and I may be wrong about that, that is not going to come to Congress. Those loans, there's two pieces here. One, those loans are guarantees that are under current authorization that he has now. And so he's moving forward on those. Now, the second part of this, which I think where you're going is within the Kerry-Lieberman-Graham bill, there is additional authorization as well as research and development issues around nuclear energy. I think that's the piece that you're referring to. Now, that legislation is pending right now. We're going to look at it. I will be frank with you. One of the biggest pieces that I'm going to be interested in is what kind of research dollars are going to be put aside for just what you talked about, waste disposal, because it's not clear that we have a safe, obviously, and plenty of reports to tell us this. We do not have a safe way to dispose of this for indefinite periods of time. There is obviously periods of time you can dispose of it, but not permanently. So that is the piece that I'm going to be looking at, that legislation. To be very frank with you, I'm hopeful that when we come back from this break, we are actually going to work on an energy, comprehensive energy plan. So we'll have this discussion. But the president has authority now to move forward on those loan guarantees. That's already been authorized under past Congresses. It's the future that a lot of us are going to be looking at, and the technology and the research dollars to determine can and is there a way to make sure we put that waste in a place that or reutilization of it in some ways that we don't have to worry about it into the future. That's not clear yet. But that's going to come down probably. You bet. That will come down when we get back.
Thanks for your call, Jim. And Senator, did I hear in there that you feel that the Kerry Lieberman is probably the best framework for a compromise to move forward on energy strategy?
I think so. I think from Alaska's perspective, we've done fairly well in there. I haven't signed on to the bill because I think there's some gaps still. But just to give you a sense, you know, revenue sharing is in there at a rate of 37.5%, which would mean billions of dollars to the state of Alaska. I think there is some good technology development around renewable energy and efforts to incentivize that. In Alaska, we see a lot of that now in the wind energy in Western Alaska, in Southeast with hydro. We actually have language in a separate bill that allows Southeast hydro to move forward and get the credits just like any other renewable energy. So I think it's the piece, but there are two or three other pieces of legislation. There's one sponsored by Senator Bingaman, and there's one sponsored by Senator Dorgan. I do believe those will kind of morph into this one piece of legislation. And I know when Sue asked her question, I was probably fairly aggressive about it. That is, you know, Congress of the last decade plus, both Democrat and Republican, failed to get us an energy policy that we can look forward to and know that we will not be subjected to international pressures because we have to buy oil from their countries. We are not in the position that we should be in. It risks our national security, risks our economic security. So some of us advocated during this spill activity in the first few weeks, there was a desire to push energy off. A group of us said no. You know, why are we where we're at? Because we never look at energy in a comprehensive way. What we do is we do little bits and pieces. And then every constituency group, every special interest is satisfied with some tax credit or some deal they got. My approach, I campaigned on this and I'm not giving up on it. I said, we are going to move down this path and push at a comprehensive energy plan. So 30, 40 years from now, my son can look at a different kind of portfolio that we're managing our energy resources on. And if we're not smart about this, one, we will be harmed economically. Two, we will be harmed national security-wise. And three, we will miss the future jobs of this country and this world. And so I'm pretty adamant about this. And I'm not bashful. My leadership wanted to move on to immigration as the next issue. I went to the leadership with a couple others and said, well, I'm not interested in immigration right now. What I'm interested in is an energy plan. And that's what we're going to discuss when we get back.
Senator Mark Begich is our guest on Talk of Alaska. A half hour left to go as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
And it's Talk of Alaska. Senator Mark Begich is our guest. And we've been talking energy. We've been talking spill. We've been talking what's next in Washington, D.C. And I'd like to go to Tom, who joins the program from Anchorage. You've been waiting patiently here, Tom. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Senator Begich.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Mark. I'm wondering about your support for immediate offshore drilling here, because the same methodology that BP used to get its spill plans approved in the Gulf is the same that is being used by Shell in the Arctic. It's clearly overstating their ability to respond to a catastrophic spill. BP said that they could recover 250,000 barrels of oil per day, and it's clear they can't get anywhere close to 19,000 barrels per day. I've sent your office all kinds of materials demonstrating that Shell refuses to use the American Society of Testing and Materials standard for calculating skimmer efficiencies, a scientific methodology that Shell itself helped produce. And I sent you all kinds of documentation about how the Coast Guard and DEC have been colluding to deny Alaskans their right to protections under OPA 90. With all of the corruption now even admitted by President Obama in regulatory oversight and clear collusion between state and regulators to deny Alaskans the protections they deserve under the law, how is it that you won't even support a reexamination of the scientific methodology and technology needed to protect Alaskans' statutory and constitutional rights?
Tom, let me say this, and thank you for your call last night. It was Memorial Day, so I didn't call you back, but I have. I know Bob has gotten all your material. I have seen portions of it, and I appreciate the emails that you personally send me. So I'm familiar with the material. But let me make very clear, I'm not sure where you get the position that I won't support reviewing those initiatives. I'll tell you right now, Shell has gotten a delay up there because they've been required to go through an additional safety efforts. I've just finished talking to the president of the company last week, Marvin Odom, specifically talking to him about some of the requirements and some of the issues that I'm concerned about. What I've said is, you know, what we battle with right now is people just saying no more offshore, period. And my view is, one, that's short-sighted, that's an emotional response, and three, it actually aggravates me that we have no problem in sucking up as much oil as possible to drive our cars, fly our planes, do everything else, and then we close our eyes to where we're getting this oil. And we're getting it from countries that don't like us, that have significantly lower environmental standards, and we don't mind if they mess up their country, but we don't mind consumption of their products. So that's where I stand, and that's why when I say that OCS, I believe when you're dealing on the Arctic with 70 pounds per square inch, 75 feet down drilling versus the Gulf, 5,500 feet down drilling, 2,000 pounds per square inch, there's a difference. Now, saying that, there is a much greater risk in the sense of if you took Arctic versus Cook Inlet, you know, because Cook Inlet, we have resources nearby to respond. So all that's part of the equation. It's why I've advocated for additional forward positioning of the Coast Guard up toward the Arctic. Their biggest problem is not a capacity for deep water porting, but there's some ideas they have, and I think that's an important piece of it. It's why last year I supported and brought forward a piece of legislation on Arctic spill response and technology development, because I think that's critical. But what I don't want us to get caught up in is suddenly a moratorium because it's politically advantageous to throw Alaska over the shore once again. And my view is, can you do OCS? Yes. Can you do it safely? I believe you can. Do we need better involvement and more technology? Yes, we do. The Gulf has taught us some lessons here that we have to take into account as we move forward. And I think this delay, may I not personally like it, it gives time for additional response and review. So your information has been very helpful, at least for me, to start seeing pieces of the equation that I can have conversations with the oil industry as well as the bureaucracy. And I agree with you, the bureaucracy, MMS down in the Gulf, and I'll comment just on the Gulf, has major problems. And I think what the president's doing, what Secretary Salazar is doing, splitting these up from regulatory versus permitting to the folks that will go out and review these platforms for their performance and response, I'm glad they're splitting it up. That's the way it should have been done. It's the way when I was mayor, we never had the platting officer or the zoning officer who gave you the permit to build a subdivision also be the same people that then regulate you. We had two different, zoning enforcement was one area, platting and planning zoning was another area. So I want to Again, Tom, you've been very, your information, and you and I have to be very frank here, he has reams of information, and they've been very informative. And I know Bob, my staff in D.C., Bob King, has perused it a great deal, and there's some thoughts that we're going to start moving forward on.
Mark, they're still refusing to use scientific methodology in evaluating skimmer effectiveness, and they're refusing to use the only proven technology that is effective in Arctic conditions, both in Cook Inlet and on a North Slope.
What is that, Tom? Burning? What?
Well, first, if you want to talk about burning, nobody's even studied the effects of the soot coming back down on the ice, which makes it more bioavailable to marine mammals using the surface of the ice.
Oh, dear. Hey, Tom, it's I think it's getting too technical for us. I think we probably got as specific a response as we're going to get out of Senator Begich.
Yeah, and I'll just end on this, Tom. And I would say I would not use the word, you know, today they may be refusing. I think the day that the way we're going to deal with oil and gas development in the future is going to change. I mean, there's no question. What has been going on from 40 days ago prior to where we are today and what we're going to be a year from now is going to be significantly different. And I think the industry clearly understands the standards are going to change. And the Arctic, you know, we are not going to do development in the Arctic if it is not safe. But I believe that there are ways to manage this the right way, and but we're gonna take our time, and that's what's about to happen now. That's obvious because the administration is not interested in allowing them to produce this year. Now, saying that, I think there's a lot of technology out there, the North Sea, that has done an enormous amount of offshore drilling in really, you know, when you think about the waves in their area, it's high seas, and so you know, we're gonna reexamine all this. That's what's going on now.
Yeah, thank you for your call, Tom, and for all your research you've put into this.
He's done a great job, and we appreciate it.
Fred in Haines, looks, Senator, like we're not going to be able to get off of this topic here. Fred in Haines, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is kind of a fundamental how the free enterprise system works in relation to this BP oil spill. Because when the oil's pumping away and everything's in good shape, you know, BP's making tons of money, and they're retaining the profits and distributing it to their shareholders. And when something goes wrong, all of a sudden it's everybody's problem. And everybody's taking the liability of it, and everyone's absorbing the damage of the risks. So I'm trying to understand why, you know, everyone doesn't share in the profits when we're all absorbing the risk.
That's
the fundamental free enterprise system says those who take the risk make the profits.
Yeah,
so where are we astray now?
Yeah, that's an interesting. That's a great philosophical question. I don't know the answer to. I will say this: that you know, prior to those leases being let, obviously it was our value. Now, how do we benefit from it? Our profits. We're leasing the space. We're leasing the oil reserve for them to utilize and extract from. So we may not get the profit, but we are getting revenue stream. And that is the free enterprise system. In other words, if I own a parcel of land and I lease it out for someone to build a big building on it, and then it happens to be a Costco where they're making a ton of money, I don't get the share in that profit, but I've leased the land. So the free enterprise system does work. Now,
I remember, I think it was Milne Point state leases where the state got 90% royalty,
right,
and they still explored it. I think it was Conoco.
That's right. And so that's how we get our, you know, it's our negotiated rate of return on the lease and the royalty percent. That's how we do it. Now, in Norway, they do it a little different. They not only do it that way, they actually own part of a company that does exploration. And what they do is every lease that they let out, their oil exploration company that is owned by the people own a piece of that. And so therefore, they not only get the revenue stream off of royalty and taxes and so forth, they now own a piece of the rock. That's a philosophy that they developed in Norway and what they're doing there. Now, that's different than what we've done. We've done just a straight land lease and royalty share. So that's how the free enterprise system works at this point here. I have a feeling on the liability piece of it, that's going to change.
Yeah, Fred, if that's what your question is going to, is a $75 million cap. He's already addressed it, and it's pretty undecided right now, but it's certain to be changed.
I mean, why should it be limited at all?
Well, that's a question that we really need to ask the people that wrote it into Open 90. I think what their thinking was to keep it from going into litigation. And that may still turn out to be the case.
Right, but I will say, when I use the word limit, I mean, I say it only for discussion. What it will be, I mean, it's going to be significant. I mean, $75 million is lunch money. You know, I hate to be so crass about it. That is... to be very frank with you, it's an embarrassment. That's the limit. And what we have to have is a couple pieces to the equation. I'm going to suggest some stuff over the next week here. I'm actually going to have a meeting on Wednesday from here back to D.C. on legislation that I've working on, we're crafting. I actually, the working title is Boot on the Neck, meaning that I've taken it from Secretary Salazar that when and if, and of course, the goal here is not to have a spill, but if it happens, that we want to make sure that every dime, every penny that is owed to cleaning up, to the businesses, to the individuals, to the economic harm of not only today but into the future is covered by the companies at fault. And that is how we're approaching it. But I call it, for a working title, I call it the boot on the neck legislation.
Fred and Haynes, I want to thank you for your call.
Thanks very much for handling my call. Thanks.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. And up to Shishmaref now, and Robert, really close to the Chukchi. Robert, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Senator Begich, for accepting the call.
Yes.
I got a question. You know, is this bill going to affect the price of oil? And then not only that, you know, I'm against this oil development here on the Chukchi Sea, since Shishmaref is, you know, pretty close, or we are related to the Chukchi Sea. Now, if we ever had an oil spill, and if it did travel underneath the ice, there's no way you guys going to be ever track it or recover it till the ice thaws. And exactly how far and where is this oil going to go is going to be the next question. And, you know, you could put a man on the moon, but you ain't going to be able to clean up this kind of mess like what's going on in the lower 48. But my other question is, how much at the end of the spill going to be, are we going to have an oil price, another spike in the price of fuel or gas that's going to hit it? Rural Alaska.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, I was asked this last week on a national news commentary, and I have to tell you that I think there is going to be a spike. Now, how significant is one question, and here's why I say this. Part of the cost of oil is these speculators. They speculate on crisis in order to make money trading oil and gas. They don't even use it. They just It's this Wall Street mentality of basically we don't care who wins or loses, they just want to make money. And so there's about a 15-20% part of the price of what we pay in fuel. It doesn't matter if you're in Anchorage or in Shishmaref or wherever you might be, you're paying for these speculators, which is something we've tried to hammer down on. So I think there will be a movement up. Not at this point do I think significant. And the reason I say that is because it's focused on one well. What will drive the potential price up is how the president's commission that he's put together on to study what this all means. Because if they come out 6 months from now and say, you know, we're not going to do XYZ anymore around oil and gas, then you're going to see, I think, some additional spiking in pricing. But I also am concerned that some will use this as an excuse to raise prices. Now, putting that all into the mix, that's on the oil side. The thing that is of value, especially in the Chukchi, which is a high value, is gas. That's a clean burning fuel, easy to manage in a case of a ruptured line or a blowout or anything of that nature, much easier to manage. But the problem is, right now, you know, we're still arguing over if we're going to have a gas line. Without a gas line, we can't even talk about the issue of gas. That's the alternative fuel in the future. That's why in this legislation we talked about earlier, this show, the Carrie Lieberman bill, we have incentives to move the trucking fleet into gas off of oil and diesel, because that's a higher value in the sense of cleaner burning fuel. And from Alaska's perspective, that's our future. Oil is a piece of it. Gas is the future. And it's a clean burning fuel, much more a lot easier to manage in a sense of an environmental issue. But I think there's going to be, we'll watch how the report comes out. That will determine, I think, what the outcome of production will be. And if the production is going to go down, meaning less production of oil and gas, and that means more import of oil, then you're going to see some price impact in a, you know, in a negative way. And the problem with that is that's going to be just about midwinter, or just the beginning of winter could be the potential of your last barges coming in. That is a problem, because they may spike it in anticipation. That's what we have to watch. And I think the state of Alaska, this is where the Oil and Gas Commission and the governor's office should be very aggressive about to watch the spiking and help manage that.
Robert, I want to thank you for your call from Shishmaref there, Robert.
That was a good question.
I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
All right, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Senator Mark Begich is our guest on Talk of Alaska. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255. So far, it's the matter of the spill, and oil and gas policy has dominated the show, and it looks like it's going to continue in that vein. The next call comes from Segaruk in Kotzebue. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Senator Begich. Thank you for hosting this radio show. I've been listening, and I'm so glad that you're addressing this and listening to a variety of people talking from all over the state. So I appreciate the hard work that you guys are doing. And I know in our region, in the Nana region, we've been having some really good discussions on the pros and cons of what's happening in the Gulf and how it affects our Chukchi Sea area. So this is something that we're watching really, really, really closely. And I was wondering how much weight you're giving to the coastal communities when you make your decisions. And the reason I ask is we've seen time and time again where decisions are made on our behalf and we are not involved in that process. And for something as big as this and the decisions that are made on our coastal communities, we need to be involved in the part of the decision-making process for this to work. Otherwise, you're going to get a lot of defensive people. And we want to make sure that, you know, when you talk about the value of gas in the Chukchi Sea, we have something that's even more valuable, and that's our culture and that's our traditions. And we just need to make sure that we are involved in the mitigation process for how we're going to be dealing with this down in the future. And I know that we have to work on the consumption of oil and gas for everyone, everybody from Kotzebue to Los Angeles. Everybody is consuming oil and gas for our cars and boats and our travel, et cetera. But we also need to continue to look at alternative energy sources. And the other point I wanted to make is to make sure that we have an oversight committee to partner with oil companies. We know that we have no jurisdiction, and it's beyond us. There's going to be decisions made by the federal government with OCS, but we need to have a local oversight committee so that we are involved in that process. And I know it's a really tough decision all in all, but I look forward to working with you. And it's really tough for us, but this is something that we really need to put some weight on when you do make your decision-making, is to keep the local people involved in the decision-making process. And we want to make sure that our local traditions are alive for many, many, many generations to come. and a lot of the oil that's going to be extracted is going to be for a short period of time. And I think we're taking all the risk. We're going to get minimal benefit. And it's just something that we've seen over the years with resource extraction, especially from rural Alaska. And when there are, and I appreciate the work that you're doing on revenue sharing, because if anyone's going to make some money off of this, we need to be a huge part of that in the highest cost of living in the entire state. So you have a lot of work cut out for you, but we're here. We're ready to help you to solve and work on solutions as we move forward. But I guess the bottom line is the value. We need to put more weight in the value of our indigenous peoples and our cultural traditional people to make sure that that's long-lasting and will last for generations to come. And think about that more as a value as opposed to the monetary value. So I wish you lots of luck with the work that you're doing. And again, my question is, how much weight are you giving to coastal communities to make your decisions on offshore drilling in the Chukchi Sea?
You bet. Thank you very much. And first off, I will tell you, I get many different groups, especially from the coastal communities as well as from interior also, not just coastal, because there's a huge value of preserving the culture, not just on culture, but throughout Alaska. And so I get a lot of input on the oil and gas development, especially. I know Mayor Itta is on a regular basis giving us information, ideas, thoughts, and how to connect. One thing I proposed last year, which oddly enough, some of the coastal communities didn't support, and that was a regional advisory council, very similar to what we have down in Valdez. I thought that was a good idea. We got pushback. I have a feeling now we're bringing it back because we think this is the right thing to do, where you have a role, a good role, a strong role, not just, you know, if they contact you, you will be part of the equation. And I think it needs to be formalized. The second thing is, you mentioned revenue sharing. You're absolutely right. If there is going to be development, the revenue sharing legislation that I've put into play not only includes all the different government agencies, but includes tribal governments as a recipient of those resources. Mine's the only one that does that. And I believe that it's from all layers of impacted government services that need to have that revenue stream. Just to give you an idea on Chukchi alone, when that lease was done, if we would have had revenue sharing, it would have been $1 billion just on the revenue sharing for that lease. The third is what you're doing in Kotzebue, for example, with the wind farm you're developing in the sense of the diesel to wind project is a great example of what we need to be doing more of, getting people off of diesel, off of very expensive fuels to more renewable and alternative energy sources. And we, meaning we collectively, the state of Alaska, the federal government, need to continue to invest in that area. But to your core question, absolutely, the coastal communities, communities at large are engaged, and we're on a regular basis talking to them. But I think this regional advisory council, as they have down in Valdez, which has worked very well, they're at the table. They're part of. They're kind of like the eyes from the outside looking in, and that's valuable.
Well, if you, can you intervene perhaps with the Interior Department to get a little bit better? Obviously, they're going to consider giving the nod to Chukchi exploration plan at some point. Maybe there could be some local consultation.
Well, one of the things that's, the president's put as a mandate is tribal consultation. This is a perfect area. We've actually asked not only the Interior Department, but every department that's engaged in Alaska to fulfill the president's requirement, which is tribal consultation on activities within areas that impact tribes. And Alaska is a perfect place to see that happen. That's every department, not just Interior, because there's some other issues with other departments, as you know.
All right, Senator Mark Begich, thank you so much for being with us. Have a nice flight back to Washington, D.C.
Okay, I just encourage folks tonight at 7 p.m., you might get a call. That's our Teletown Hall meeting. Feel free to participate.
All right, renewable energy next week. Kristen Spock on the controls, Josh Edge, and B.D. Trentini on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.